I love a good mystery, and so does everyone else. In fact, everyone loves a good family mystery, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey.
I know that our listeners will absolutely love this game because you are uncovering the mystery of June's sister's murder, and you're becoming a detective. You're looking for clues, and each scene will lead you to a new thrilling storyline.
This is a great way to engage your observation skills to uncover key pieces of information that lead you on to many chapters of mystery, danger, and romance. Right now, I'm in the process of interviewing family members, and this is bringing me back, just so you know, to my days in law enforcement, and I'm having such a blast with it because it is so much more lighthearted, but it also has the mystery of where will this take me?
You can even chat and play with or against other players by joining a detective club. You'll even get the chance to play in a detective league to put your skills to the test. Megan, I think we should join a detective club together. We've got this.
Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover
inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ladies, welcome to Serial Streamers. It is so fun having you on. As you know, usually I'm solo, and so it's always fun when I can invite a couple friends on the show so we can chat. And it always feels more like I'm in the living room having wine with my friends talking about this like crazy documentary that we all watched. And this one was wild. So I cannot wait to talk about it with you all, but why don't we just have you both introduce yourselves, give a little bit about your background.
Hi, Jamie. First of all, thank you for having us on this show. We were really excited to collaborate with you. And this is also a documentary that our audience has wanted to hear more about. My name is Megan Sachs. I'm the co-host of Women in Crime podcast, and I'm a criminologist. And this is a case that I actually covered in an episode, our Patreon exclusive episode. So I'm familiar with a lot of the inside baseball on this one as well. And I can't wait to geek out about it.
Oh, me too.
I'm Megan's other half as her co-host on Women in Crime. I am also a criminologist working at Fairleigh Dickinson University. Megan, you forgot to mention you also work there.
Oopsie.
So our day jobs are criminology professors and, you know, then we podcast on the side. But I'm very excited to be here, Jamie. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, Amy and Megan, and a little bit about your podcast as well. I know it's female-centric, which I love because I have a particular fascination with female perpetrators just because it's more rare and for other reasons as well. And as we know, unfortunately, women are mostly the victims of crime as well. Mm-hmm. But a little bit about your podcast.
Sure.
Oh, my turn now.
I love how polite you both are with each other.
We don't like to talk over each other. We've come a long way from that. So on our podcast, every week we cover a different woman. Sometimes she's a victim, sometimes she's an offender. Oftentimes, as you know, Jamie, they could be one and the same. And we also cover cases of women who are heroes in some way or have changed the criminal justice system in some way. And besides telling the story, we like to focus on the criminological theories that can help us understand how or why this happened, how we can prevent it from happening again in the future, what policies or procedures could be put in place, and as our listeners love, we try to do action items as well. Mm-hmm. What can our listeners do to get more involved in a certain topic or learn more about something?
I appreciate you both for doing that work. It is so much needed. And also, your podcast is called Women and Crime, and it is available wherever podcasts are available. Cool. Well, you know, I want to start things off by giving the quickest synopsis ever that existed on Earth for this documentary, because I just kind of want to dive in with you ladies and have a casual conversation about our thoughts, our theories, our perspectives, both from a personal standpoint, a female standpoint, a professional standpoint. There's just so much to talk about. Obviously, I'm going to miss a few things, but I'm assuming most people watching or listening right now have actually seen this documentary, Lover, Stalker, Killer. It's on Netflix. It just came out recently. But basically, there is a guy named Dave. And this happens, what, right around 2000. Dave Krupa, he's working at a truck stop, meets an attractive woman named Amy. They fall in love. They get married. They have kids together. But the relationship falls apart at some point and they do get a divorce. And Amy moves, I think, to Omaha, Nebraska, right? To be closer to her family. I think that's where she's originally from. And Dave, you know, being the good father that he is, wants to be closer to his kids. So he also moves to Omaha, Nebraska to be closer to the kids. Well, Dave finds himself newly single. He gets on the dating sites. And what do you know? You know, he meets a couple of ladies. I think one of the first women he meets, her name is Liz Gollier, and they go on a few dates. They seem to have a ton in common. They love heavy metal music. They love motorcycles. Like, it's all just clicking. But Dave, I think, is very clear with Liz, like, hey, I don't want to get too tied down. I kind of just want to keep this light and fluffy. So they see each other, and then Dave ends up meeting another woman named Carrie Farver, and she's this attractive woman, and he meets her, I believe, while he's working at an auto body shop, and he's just kind of, you know, struck by her. He's attracted to her. He goes back onto his dating website, and sure enough, he finds Carrie on that website or dating app, and then he links up with her. They go on some dates. They kind of click, and at one point, Dave has Carrie at his apartment, and Liz, the first woman he met, shows up unannounced. And shortly after that, basically, it kind of goes down like this. Dave has Carrie at his apartment. I think she stays overnight. He wakes up that morning, leaves her at his apartment, goes to work. Soon after he gets to work, he gets this strange text message from Carrie. And it's like, hey, I think we should move in together. And he's really shocked by that because he's like, I thought I was, you know, kept it real with you that I want to keep things light and fluffy. I thought I told you, like, let's just keep this light and fluffy. Well, then the text messages from Carrie just go downhill from there. And she's like, fuck you. You ruined my life. I'm going to ruin your life like you ruined my life. Yeah, just very angry. And what happens from there is now essentially Carrie begins texting threatening text messages to Dave, very dark, threatening. I know where you are. I see you. She begins stalking him and things begin to unfold from there. But we would find out, you know, and I guess we can just do a spoiler alert. I mean, we're going to talk about, but, you know, essentially it's not Carrie at all. In the end, they discover that it was actually Liz the entire time acting like she was Carrie, sending these messages as if she's Carrie, thousands upon thousands. I see you. I'm going to kill you. Like, just horrible, horrible stalker text messages. And things unfold from there. And then we do find out toward the end of the documentary that it wasn't Carrie at all. And meanwhile, while Carrie, in quotes, is sending these text messages and stalking Dave, she's nowhere to be found. Like, her mom doesn't know where she is. Her mom even gets a strange Facebook message at one point, assumingly from her daughter, but we would find out later it was not from Carrie at all. So it's very bizarre. And you're like, gosh, why did Carrie just flip on Dave like that? She seemed like such a great girl. But we would find out toward the end that actually it was Liz all along. And this case is very dark. But I guess that's my synopsis. But we can talk more about the details of actually what happened and how things ended. But let me open up the discussion and just kind of say, I know, Megan, you've been obsessed with this case for quite some time, and you guys have covered it. What are your overall first thoughts on this story and this documentary?
Well, first of all, I thought the documentary was really well done. It was super interesting, and it was done, I thought, in a way that was respectful. So I appreciated that because I do like true crime documentaries, but I don't like all of them. And I don't like certain ones that I think are more salacious anyway. This one was well done, so I appreciate that. There's a lot to this story to unpack. It's really complicated. I'd like to say that to begin with, I think that Dave Krupa is just a nice guy.
Yeah.
I think that he's, you know, he's a sweet guy who meant well. I think he's, you know, fairly harmless or innocuous. And he was upfront with both Liz and Carrie about the fact that he's new to the dating game and he wants to date, but he's not ready to settle down right away. So I appreciate that he was honest about it. He wasn't trying to hide that. It did seem to me like he really got along with Liz quite well, but maybe it almost ran its course. And when he met Carrie, I think he was just struck by her. I think he was a little bit more taken with Carrie. And it was also a natural meeting that they had. My impression was that even though he told Carrie, look, I'm not looking for something serious, it was actually about a 2-week period where they were spending most nights together because Dave lived near her work, and they were getting along really well. And Dave said it wasn't just a sexual relationship. They were really connecting. He liked their talks and their time together. And so while I think that he wasn't looking to jump into moving in together after 2 weeks, I actually think there probably was a future for the two of them naturally progressing. That's just one thing. And one observation about the relationships and how they differed. I'll let Amy jump in.
Yeah, I agree with you. That was my take as well, that it seemed like they could have made something of this relationship had Carrie not gone missing.
Yeah. Overall, I too thought the documentary was wonderful. I don't watch that many true crime documentaries, to be honest. I did know about the case, so I was watching it through a different lens. But watching that, thinking about someone who doesn't know the story, it was done brilliantly. The way it just unfolded everything without giving away what happens. Even though I knew the story, I still found myself on the edge of my seat somehow. I really think that this case is so complicated. We didn't get into the details yet, but I think one thing that I think stuck out more than anything is just the lengths that Liz would go. The way she, you know, not only was she stalking Dave, she was sending threatening messages to Amy, threatening the children, not to spoil the biggest part of the documentary, but setting her own home on fire when her pets were inside.
Her animals.
That put her in a different, you're looking at someone now who has sociopathic traits or psychopathic traits. And once that happens, to me, the whole story changes course. She's no longer just someone who's love struck, who's a stalker. She's somebody who has some serious personality disorders and likely has mental illness.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I couldn't believe in the documentary that nobody was like, and she killed her own pets.
Yeah, they brushed over it, right?
I know. Yeah, it's such a big deal. That sets her apart. And I'm not an expert by any means, but I would imagine that from a psychological standpoint sets her apart from a lot of killers, a lot of perpetrators, because there are people who do the most heinous acts and they still love their own pets.
Yeah.
They still would never. So it's that was, and obviously it's not as bad because she just killed her pets. That's almost the worst of the worst. But she also set her own house on fire. That is a big deal.
And she had children who lived there as well. So she's traumatizing her own children for the sake of, you know, this plot. It's unbelievable.
She shot herself in the leg, too.
Oh, yeah. Forgot that. About that.
Which is still not as bad as killing the pets, but it also struck me.
I agree. I know.
I agree. It's like, okay, this woman set her own house on fire, hers and her children's house on fire. She killed her own pets. She shot herself. And also what struck me, just from a psychological standpoint, was her attitude, her demeanor in the interrogation. She was almost like entitled and like, how dare you question me? Like, fuck off. She just had such an attitude of
that.
I think that tells you something about her psyche. I don't know what, but it tells you something.
I'm curious what you both think, because I was kind of under the impression, at least from the documentary, that at some point, I don't even think it was about Dave anymore. I think it was just about control. I got the feeling she didn't even care if she ended up with Dave. Do you agree with that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a point where she's moved on from Dave. So it's she's not really she's stalking him still. But it's like she was in a different relationship. Mm-hmm. So if some information about Dave came out, it was almost like that incensed her. And yes, there was definitely, Amy, I agree, a level of control over him. So one thing that's not included in the documentary that I would love to share with you both, Amy, I don't know if you recall, is I know a bit about Liz's background. Do either one of you? Sorry.
No,
I don't recall.
I had never heard of this before the documentary. So,
okay. So I think that it's helpful, at least for our discussion, to know that Liz had extreme trauma in her background. Specifically as a child, she had an awful childhood. So she was raised by her mother, who her father was not in the picture. He was an abusive alcoholic who I believe was either charged with, not convicted, I'm not sure, to be honest, but at least charged with child molestation against other children. So he was not allowed to be around his own children. And her mother went on to either live with or marry another very abusive man who abused Liz and her brother. And so Liz and her brother were removed from her mother's care and placed in foster care for a long period of time. When they were about to be reunited, Liz's mother was in a tragic accident, struck by a car and killed. As she and her brother could not go back and live with her father, they were placed in foster care for pretty much the remainder of their childhoods. So I just want to give that as a little bit of a backdrop here for personality reasons.
And I appreciate you giving that that background. I'm sorry, Amy. I just want, Amy, going back to something you said earlier, you know, I'm learning through this true crime, you know, research and looking into these cases that, you know, there's a difference between a sociopath and psychopath. And you had said that she's demonstrating sociopathic behavior. And from what I understand, psychopaths are born, sociopaths are made. And I know that simplifies it too much, but I don't even know if that's actually accurate. But from what I have read, do you think that Liz was made, or do you think that she was born into this personality disorder that she most likely has?
I think that's the million-dollar question. I don't think there's any way to know. And also in the literature, there seems to be a debate as to what a sociopath is versus a psychopath. Neither one of them are in the diagnostic manual, so they're not actual, you know, psychological terms that can be diagnosed. So it is a little tricky. When I teach it in my classes, I tell my students, like, some people say this, some people say that. This nature-nurture idea seems to be often what sets it apart. But I've heard other researchers talk about it, you know, in other ways as well.
Yeah, well, Liz also moved on later on to get married very young, just so you know, divorced very young. She had a history of unstable relationships, which is not totally surprising either. And even more tragically, she had, you know, two children is what we learned she had during the documentary, but she had a third child, a baby who died at the hands of her boyfriend at the time from shaken baby syndrome.
Oh, wow. Yes.
And that was
so
in 1999.
Yeah. Oh. Megan, thanks for sharing that, because that kind of just sparked what I had wanted to say. And this is why this is something we try to do a lot in our podcast. A lot of documentaries are one-sided. You know, Dave was at the center of this documentary, so they weren't going to give any grace to Liz. And I'm not saying they should have, but I think it's important that we always understand all sides of the story. Not saying that Liz is not culpable, not using her experiences as an excuse or a justification, but not having that information that Megan just provided, you know, it has you look at the case in a different way. And I don't think it's fair to Liz. I know some people might say, well, she killed someone, because she did, in fact, kill Carrie, and she tormented a lot of people. So maybe no one wants to give her grace. But I think it's important for us to just understand the whole story.
I agree with you, Amy, wholeheartedly. And here's the thing. You're absolutely right. It is not an excuse. The acts she committed are absolutely deplorable and unforgivable, I'm sure. Most people would not be able to forgive. But it's also a question of, did Liz ask to be this way? Like, did she have full control or any control over who she would become? Like, and I don't know. It's just such the human brain is just so complex, and it just, everyone is unique from one to the next. I don't know the answer to that. What she did is disgusting. And I do believe she should probably spend the rest of her life in prison, because I don't know if she can be rehabilitated and not be a danger to society. I don't think so, but I don't know. But it's a good conversation to have, because without that context that you gave, Megan, we're just like, oh, she's a monster out of nowhere. Put her in prison, lock her up. She's disgusting. She hates people, and she abuses people, and she kills people. Like, But you also have to understand she was a human being. She was an innocent human being at mm-hmm. one
at some
point in her life. And yes. things happened that she didn't ask for. Mm-hmm. I think it's just very important for understanding the full context.
And also, I also had the thought that, you know, with some perpetrators, you could see that it's this particular situation. And had they not met this person, they probably wouldn't have gone on to commit the crime. In this case, right. I wonder, was it Dave and her obsession with Dave? Or if not Dave, it would have been someone else.
Sure. I love that you brought that up, too, because sometimes there are crimes of opportunity mm-hmm. where I was just talking about this last night with a producer friend of mine. And it's like there are killers out there that never would have offended had they not been presented with just this random luck. I call it luck, but, mm-hmm. you know, opportunity. Yep. Of like, oh my gosh, I'm in a dark area. I'm in a park that nobody's at. And there's somebody that I am getting feelings about. I'm going to go perpetrate right now. But they may not have ever committed that crime in their entire life if they were not presented with the right opportunity. So to your point, would Liz have just done this to anybody because that's who she is? Or was it just something about Dave that she wanted to exert that control or obsession? I don't know. It's a good question.
I think she grew obsessed with Dave, but I think it's also why I mentioned in the beginning that he struck me as a very nice guy. I read that Liz was dating, you know, for a while and had dated multiple men. I have a feeling that Dave stepped in as a nice man, maybe the first one to be really nice to her in a really long time, something that she was really missing and looking for. And they had this seemingly, even he describes it as a great relationship for a while. And I think for her, it felt right. And I think she probably did expect a lot more where they were going. And when he met Carrie or before when things started to fizzle out, I believe this really, really hurt her. Mm-hmm. So it could have been another person, but I do think there was something about the connection mm-hmm. with Dave and the person that Dave was that sort of sparked this behavior, mm-hmm. which is still all on her. But there mm-hmm. was something about Dave, I think.
That's interesting. It's almost like that's like another alternative title to another mm-hmm. documentary.
Something about Dave.
There's something about Dave because uh-huh. I think that you're onto something, Megan. That would make sense to me because given her history that you shared with us mm-hmm. of very toxic relationships in her past with men, here comes Dave. He seems like a nice guy who's not going to abuse her and not going to abuse her. He's a nice, normal. And it was that she was like, this is the first time maybe in my life that, and here he is seeing this other woman and it drove her crazy. I hate to use the word crazy, but mm-hmm. you know, she became obsessed. And I think that that's a very decent theory based on what mm-hmm. we know about Liz.
Yeah. Doesn't it seem like it also escalated pretty quickly? I mean, Dave was only with Carrie for 2 weeks and it didn't seem like Liz was even rational in the sense that she didn't talk to Dave and say like, hey, I really like you. How about me over her? Like, it just seemed like it went real quick. Like he's with someone else and this has to stop.
Great
I wonder
point.
What yeah. period of time there was. So I found myself wondering the same thing, Amy. And I don't know how long there was in between. Like, did he and Liz start to fizzle much before that? And if so, was she also watching him in that time? Was she, you know, did her stalking behavior predate Carrie?
Yes.
And she was, I don't know the answer to this, mm-hmm. but I wonder that. Like, did it happen a month before and then she was watching him? And that's how she was so aware of Carrie so quickly. Because remember, Carrie was a short relationship as well.
Yeah, but remember she mm-hmm. ran into Carrie. They crossed paths that one night. So that's how she knew she existed.
What I'm saying is, did they cross paths or did Liz cross paths with Carrie because she had been watching Dave and she was well aware of what mm-hmm. Dave was doing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That information would be helpful.
It would and be. Just, I would love to know.
Oh, I would too. And obviously, my recap earlier was super short and I'm missing a lot. And I think we're going to hit a lot of like what actually happened, what mm-hmm. unfolded in our conversation. But essentially, Liz is posing as Carrie for, I mm-hmm. want to say, at least like a year or so.
Oh, more than
probably more
several
than that.
Okay. Several so years.
And there were thousands upon thousands of emails mm-hmm. and text messages. And she not only stalked and threatened Dave, but then, like you said, it moved on to his ex-wife, Amy, mm-hmm. and the kids. And then, and all the while, Carrie is nowhere to be found. At some points, law enforcement does get involved, but they can't really make headway. Then there's these two new investigators who are like, hey, can we take on this case? Their boss says, yeah, go for it. And they start to figure things out and they determine fairly quickly that like Carrie's probably not alive, unfortunately.
Do you recall how they did? Like, to me, it was fascinating how like the first piece that kind of opened the door for this investigation when they were looking at the IP addresses where these texts were coming from. It's so interesting. And then it was traced back to this one home, which happened to be someone who worked in, I guess, that county, right? And it turned out Liz was dating that guy. And I was like, what?
That was so fascinating. So essentially, there were these two investigators got a guy, forgot his name, but he was an IT expert. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They got him involved.
He's a quirky, able to, quirky IT expert.
He added some flavor to the documentary. He traces back a particular IP address to the home of a man named Todd Butterbaugh, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he quickly finds out that Todd Butterbaugh, he's like, hello, I'm Todd Butterbaugh's boss. Yes. This guy works for me. And so then in questioning, I guess they find out Todd Butterbaugh had an on-again, off-again girlfriend named Liz Goliar. Is that her? Goliar?
I think it's Goliar, but
Goliar.
I don't know if I'm right.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. So basically they're like, aha. And this is the aha moment where they're like, okay, now we can trace these digital messages from a home where Liz has been staying. And they already probably suspect, or no, that's, they didn't suspect her before that. I think
that was the first time they caught on to
her. You're right. So then it kind of goes from there. And the investigators pretty quickly are like, okay, we don't think that, unfortunately, we don't think Carrie Farver is alive, but we need to find out, like, you know, what is going on here. And they're able to investigate it. And after Liz gets shot, which essentially she calls 911 and you can hear the footage, but we find out later Liz actually shot herself. So they bring her in for questioning and they're like, gosh, who would do this to you? Was it a man or a woman? She's like, well, it was a woman who did it to me. And they're already suspecting her of being involved in Carrie Farver's disappearance. So they're like, oh, what about, you know, Dave's ex-wife, Amy? Like, she seems to maybe have it out for you. And she's like, yeah, I think it was Amy because Amy's mad at me for being with her ex-husband. And so, but they all the while, they're suspecting Liz, right? But she doesn't know it. And they're like, okay, Liz, we need you to help us out. We need like all the, you know, we need to see text messages, threatening text messages from Amy to you so we can get all this evidence and we can go arrest Amy. So then what starts happening is Liz poses as Amy sending text messages or emails to herself as if it's Amy and, you know, threatening, you know, emails and basically like she kind of traps herself. And then one of the investigators also to go a step further, knowing that Liz is very likely obsessed with Dave, he's like, hey, Dave, the investigator to Dave. He's like, hey, Dave, you know, man to man, if I were you, I'd move back in with your ex-wife and kids just to keep them safe. So he does that because they knew that this would drive Liz wild and she would act out on it. And sure enough, she does. She start, they put a GPS on her car, I think, or they're tracking her. And she's every single day circling Liz's house, like just every single day.
They Amy's end up, house, or, right?
I'm sorry. Amy. Yes. Yeah. Liz is circling Amy's house. Thanks for clarifying. And eventually Liz gets arrested and, you know, goes back to my comments about what were your thoughts on the interrogation and how she was just like, she almost had an attitude of like, well, fuck you. Like, how dare you? Like almost entitled, like you're wasting my time with this.
I think that's more evidence. That's more evidence that she has a personality disorder. I think, you know, the way she was so easy, you know, able to brush things off. That's not my fault. This is, I actually even think that at some point she thought that like none of this was her fault and she had to do this to, you know, I don't know. Yeah. She seemed very delusional at some points.
She seemed to me, well, I think there's evidence of multiple personality disorders, just so you know. I also think with her history of unstable relationships and the fear that Dave was leaving her, I see other traits of borderline personality, which isn't something that, I think it's something we discussed in our episode, Amy, a little bit. So I see evidence of multiple different personality disorders.
And you don't mean multiple personality disorder.
No,
you mean,
sorry.
I just want the listeners to.
Not multiple.
Not a split personality, but like more than one personality disorder.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. I do. I also thought when I looked at her interrogation that she seems pathological. There are points where I believe that she does believe what she's saying. As Amy has said, maybe she doesn't feel responsible or she's convinced herself. She was so far into this, I would say, quote, fantasy, that she might have convinced herself that Carrie and Amy were in on this somehow together, or that Amy is responsible. So I think there's actually, most of the time, I believe Liz knew what she was doing. It's calculated. But I bet you in her immersion in some of this, and times where she was so deeply immersed in telling these stories, that she became convinced that this was almost reality.
And that she was the victim.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I could see that. That makes sense. Yes. I want to talk a little bit about, too, because I want to get your take on this. The documentary took a pretty, all of it is dark, but it took a particularly dark turn before Liz was arrested. Dave is able to find an old device, like an iPad or something, that has an SD card on it, which he gives to the IT expert who's helping to investigate the case. And he's able to reveal, he's able to unlock like all of the deleted images on that SD card. And he's shocked by what he sees because he's like, these are a bunch of selfies of Liz. So he quickly determines this is an SD card from Liz's device. And he starts scanning through the pictures. Something catches his eye. And it is a photo of a foot. And he remembers just from being curious about crime cases and things like that. And he had seen some post-mortem photos and there was some veining or something on the foot. Yes. And he's able to zoom in and it looked like it was somebody who was deceased, their foot. There was a distinct tattoo on the foot. And unfortunately that's, they're able to determine at some point that is Carrie Farver's foot. So this means Liz took a photo of Carrie's dead body after she killed her. And Liz was convicted. So we can say, you know, she murdered, she murdered Carrie Farver. Although there is still no body to this day. Is that correct?
But they don't remember all that blood they found in the car as well, though, matched Carrie's blood.
But there's no body.
No.
Yeah. So it just, I'm thankful that they were able to recover that because it built a much stronger case to get justice. But how, again, this all speaks to Liz's psyche, I think, that you took a photo. Was it a trophy photo? What was the reason?
The way the photo was taken, it almost looked to me like it was accidental. I know, like, I know it's like a far stretch because cameras back in the day, like remember the old school cameras, you have to wind up then take a picture. Yeah. Those, if you drop, sometimes they go off, but it's very rare that I think, what year was this again? They had like camera phones by then, right?
2006.
Yeah. Okay.
So it was taken with a camera phone. It was taken with a phone, I would imagine. So I don't know that it would have just went off, but it did strike me that it was like a very small part. And if she was smart, she wouldn't have taken it with an identifying characteristic like a tattoo. So either it was purposeful for some sort of trophy or to have that proof for herself, or it was just, she really didn't think that one through.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up because also a lot of times in the true crime space, people want to believe the most salacious, like she's this demented monster and this was her trophy. But that's also like, I think a more rare type of killer. It's not to say that those killers don't exist. Of course, there are serial killers who want trophies and keep trophies, but it's not, most killers are not keeping trophies and taking photo trophies. So I don't want to just assume just for a headline that, oh, this was her trophy. Yes, that is one theory and that could very well be true. But I think to your point, Amy, that makes perfect sense. The photo was not a good photo. It was kind of blurry and like weird angle. So it could have absolutely been accidental as well. But wow, like,
I don't think this was a trophy photo either, and I've heard people say that, but as someone who also teaches on serial offenders, there are various offenders that do take trophies, including photos, because they are eager to relive the experience. It gives them, like, the excitement, the joy. And, I mean, I'm not saying Liz didn't derive pleasure out of killing Carrie. Maybe she did, but her crime is more utilitarian. Carrie was in her way. She needed to get rid of her. I don't think she would have taken a trophy for the part of reliving the excitement of stabbing Carrie. And look, I could be wrong, but I agree with Amy that I think it was either accidental or that maybe there was some need just to have the proof in her head, just to know that Carrie was gone. I think it did serve some other purpose, but I don't
maybe
think
to
it was
use
a trophy.
It, maybe she was going to hang it over Dave's head at some point. Maybe she was going to send it to Dave from Amy's email at some point.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, she was very methodical. So.
Yes, she was very methodical and planned and utilitarian. So I don't think it was for the joy of reliving. I don't think it was a trophy.
Yeah. I would agree with you. Just based on what we know, I think it makes more sense that it was either accidental or there was utility or, you know, a methodical reason to take that picture, not to derive pleasure, but to like use it later or for her own purposes somehow.
Yeah. Right.
Also part of this case, this was a no-body case, which is always a huge challenge for a prosecutor. But there was a search because a couple of months after Carrie Farver disappeared, they did recover her vehicle. Mm-hmm. And in a search of the vehicle, they were able to find what looked to be a lot of blood staining in the front passenger seat, the foam of what's under the leather or whatever the, you know, the seats were made of. There was a lot of blood staining. So that also tells you that something, you know, she most likely died in her vehicle.
Yeah. No-body cases are certainly harder. I mean, when you don't have a body, you can't say for sure what happened, what the cause of death was, what the manner of death was. Was it premeditated? You know, can you tell if it was accidental? So manner of death kind of things. However, it's not always so hard to establish an actual crime or that a person is dead. In this case, the evidence, you know, there's a totality of the evidence that implies that Carrie was deceased from lack of communication with family. And I mean, phone calls and anyone seeing her in person, no bank account, no credit cards.
Nothing's touched in her apartment.
Nothing's touched in her apartment. She's not taking her medications. She's made no contact with anyone. And then you have blood, a picture. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was that hard to establish death as much in this case, but it makes it that much harder to establish how she died. And that's the problem.
But then Liz somewhat gave a confession to that when she wrote that email saying she was being Amy.
she was telling on herself in those emails that she was pretending. So the emails that she was sending to herself, trying to make it look like it was from Amy, Dave's ex-wife.
Yep.
She starts to give details about Carrie's murder. So
and
she
they
was
match
essentially,
the evidence. So yep. they're probably likely yep. the real details.
Yes. And going back to, you had just mentioned something, Megan, about the medication. So yes. there was at one point in the documentary that it was revealed that Carrie, the victim in this case, was bipolar. Mm-hmm. And so there was a theory of like, oh, maybe she didn't take her medication and she was having a mental health crisis and she just disappeared. But, you know, she didn't take anything with her. None of her belongings. Her medication was left behind. There's no bank account activity. She's not reaching out to family. So these are, like you said, to determine death. It seemed pretty clear. And then the blood in her vehicle.
She had a son and she was described as a very loving mother.
Everyone said she wouldn't have just walked out on her son like that.
This is something we discussed
in our documentary and we cover it a lot with female victims. Kudos to the two police officers who decided or asked for this case because they recognized this isn't normal. This doesn't fit the pattern. This mother who has a good job, is tight with her family, loves her son, just ups and walks away. But there's an assumption before that by other people involved that this must just be a, quote, crazy woman who went off of her meds. She's, you know, she's off somewhere. She doesn't want to be found, even though no one's heard from her. We've heard this over and over again. And I swear I remember even saying to Amy, I can't believe in the year 2006, this was still acceptable. To assume that just because this woman had documented mental illness, for which she was receiving treatment, by the way, that she would have, quote, wandered off. So one of the disturbing parts, I think, of this case for me is the pain that her son and her mother and her family had to endure by thinking or being told that she was probably off somewhere and then not knowing and thinking that she would have abandoned them. It's yet another heartbreaking really unnecessary, if you ask me, part of this case.
Yeah, it re-victimizes. It's re-victimizing the victims already.
Yeah, absolutely. And it happens, like you said, all the time. And it's shocking that it still happens. And also, I have to think like it's so much more rare for somebody to just walk away from their life. It's so much more rare. And also if they do, generally they have to live somehow, like, you know, the bank account activity, this and that. So it just, why would your brain go toward that versus something happened to this woman? And by the way, there are millions of people who have bipolar disorder who are just living their lives, paying their taxes, raising their kids. Like, it's not like you're not crazy and do crazy things like walk away from your son because you have bipolar disorder. That part really, really bothered me. And she was, by all accounts, a very loving,
responsible, dedicated woman,
responsible mother and good person.
Would they have said the same thing if it was a man who disappeared?
Oh, gosh. Because then the crazy thing couldn't be used.
Yeah. No, you know, men can't be crazy.
Yeah, men are crazy. It's women who are crazy.
Hey, would there have been more concern? Like, a man wouldn't walk away, but a woman would? I don't know. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah. But that part bothered me a lot.
I love that two detectives came in, though, and just they wanted to take this case on because they saw how wrong it was, and they saw years of inactivity. And I think they really saw this family has no answers. They're forced to believe, you know, that their daughter is somewhere terrorizing two, three other people, setting houses on fire, killing animals. So I'm so glad that someone wanted to exonerate Carrie as well and restore her reputation, because that was the only thing left that she had.
Yep. Yes, absolutely. And I will say that going back to the beginning of our conversation, I have to admit that I really thought that this documentary was well done, I did know, I figured out right from the beginning that it wasn't Carrie. And I think a lot of people did. And that's okay. It's not like you have to do this documentary in a way that, like, I'm not slamming them, because it's like they're just trying to tell a story, right? And it's not like the main.
I'm curious, Jamie, what was it about the, because I actually didn't have that feeling. So I'm curious. Okay.
And Amy knew the story.
And I knew the story.
Yes. And I've talked to people on both sides. I've heard, even on social media, I've heard people go, oh, I figured it out from the beginning. And other people were like, no, this thing kept me on the edge of my seat. My instincts were that none of this tracked. None of it made a lick of sense that Carrie. Right from that text message, that text message of her saying we should move in together, I was like, something's off.
Did you think it was Liz, though? Or you were like, it's got, you did. Interesting.
You did think it was Liz. Okay.
Yes. I thought it was Liz because she showed up unannounced and I thought that was weird. And, but I knew, I was like, Carrie's not doing this. It's not. And then, of course, as the documentary, progresses, you see that Liz is always the victim, you know, it's like, no, you're just, all this bad stuff's happening to you. Like, I just, so it's kind of like, remember that movie, The Sixth Sense?
Yes.
Yeah, my dad and I watched it and I did not figure that thing out until the end. And they gave us the answer. I was like, what? And my dad's like, I knew right from, and I'm like, Dad, you must be a genius. Like, wow. I was so impressed, you know? But with this one, I was just like, oh, yeah, it was Liz. But but I have talked to so many, like, I've seen so many different social media comments where everybody's, some people are like, oh, I knew from the beginning. And other people are like, oh, whoa, no, it kept me on the edge of my seat. But I thought it was very well done. It was respectful. It told the story factually and not in a salacious way.
Do you know what's interesting?
Good information.
I heard an interview with, I don't know if he was the director or the producer, one of the, you know, one of the people that were heavily involved in the making of it. And they said that, well, you know, Dave was involved in the reenactments, as you saw. But they used another actor for any time he was interacting with any of the women because it would be too traumatizing. They didn't want to re-traumatize him. So they took a lot of care in having his voice and him play himself, but only when it wasn't harmful. I thought that was super cool.
I am so glad you brought that up, because another one of my just random thoughts is that he is a victim in this.
Yes.
Obviously, you know, Carrie Farver lost her life. She is the ultimate victim, and it's absolutely affected her family, her loved ones so greatly. But there were multiple, there were multiple victims, and Amy and her children. Dave was so like, kind of like, didn't show a lot of emotion in this. He's just kind of like telling the story. And I'm not even slamming him for that. That's not what this is. But he he's been through so much, but he didn't show it, like, mm-hmm. you know, but I'm sure he processed it in his own way. And this is several years after, but he absolutely was a victim. Can you imagine how terrifying it is to be watched, and like you're drinking coffee at a cafe and it's like, I can see you, and your kids are in danger at some point and you don't know where this monster is, like,
or remember when he went to look for her, she said she was at the apartment complex and he like walked to look, and I was like, I would be out of there so fast. I would have moved across the country. He's so brave that he even, I know he has family there and a job, but the fact that he stayed in that apartment, like, he's a brave guy.
I was with Dave. I was walking with him, just so you know, Amy. I was like, I'm going to confront. I knew it happened too. And I'm going to confront this person.
But he was angry. He was very angry and felt invaded. And by the way, let's talk about the fact that he bought a gun for safety. He goes to look for the gun one day and it's gone.
So
and that
creepy.
Was the gun that Liz shot herself with. So she went inside his house. Yeah.
How many times do you think she had done that? That definitely wasn't the first.
Yeah, so no, I think she went in multiple times for sure.
Whoa.
Like, she's brazen, very brazen. You know, it's like you become emboldened with every act and in a pattern of stalking where it starts out and you can keep getting away with each act. She escalated. And this is the big fear with stalking. And when it wasn't taken as seriously in the 80s or prior to the 80s, because they were like, oh, it's just someone's just a nuisance or they're just annoying. It's no big deal.
Oh, I hate the peeping Tom thing. I've said it in a previous episode. We need to change the name because that sounds too light.
Peeping Tom
is very dangerous.
They escalate. They escalate into, and we know countless stories about where the actions escalate, and you see it happen. This is classic in her case. It just kept going until, you know, I would say one of the interesting things about her case is that she committed the ultimate act, you might say, very early on. The murder of Carrie happened quite early. But then she escalated in other ways and just kept going with it. It's like she had to up the ante at every turn for this to be more and more extreme. I also think the reward from her was remember how she and Dave had not been seeing each other, but this upping the ante with every bad thing that happened to her, it had a good outcome for her and the closeness that she shared with Dave.
Because they almost like trauma bonded and got back together through all this, right? I had a note that said trauma bond, and I don't know if that's exactly what it was, but
it sounds
he
like
was
it.
Frightened because he's, you know, thinks he's being stalked and threatened by Carrie. And now, Liz is being stalked and threatened by Carrie. They both share the same perpetrator, and then it brought them closer together.
And Liz knows that, and she perceives that. She's getting that every time something happens to her. She's going, oh, but then Dave is there for me, and we're even closer. And what this does is solidifies my relationship with Dave. So it's rewarding.
And Dave probably felt guilty because it was because of him that Carrie was, Carrie was stalking Liz and setting her house on fire. So Dave probably felt horrible.
He just went through the gamut of emotions, I imagine. He's been put through so much.
I felt so bad for her in the end.
I did too. And watching this documentary and hearing the details of the story, I sort of resonated with because I've never been through anything like what Carrie or Dave has been through. But I was, you know, when I was 18 years old, I don't know if I've talked to you guys about this, but I put an episode out about it early on when I started Murderish. When I was 18 years old, my parents were newly divorced and my mom and I lived in a bottom floor apartment in this nice area of Redlands, California, where I grew up. We're living in this apartment. And one night, my mom, during this time, she was studying for the bar exam. You know, she was going to be a lawyer. And it was like nighttime. It was June, so it was summertime, but the sun was not out. It was nighttime. And I'm like, oh, Mom, I'm going to go across the street to Stater Brothers. It's a grocery store. I'm going to grab a few things. I'll be right back. Got in my car, go to Stater Brothers, come home. There's a series of details I could share with you. We could talk offline, you know, at another time. But there were things that I noticed, but nothing alarming, just things I noticed. And to make a very long story short, when I walked home, I got into my apartment. I went straight to my mom's bedroom, kind of just chatted with her about what I had bought at the store, like yada yada, small talk. I go to walk into my bedroom and there's a man in my bedroom. And basically this man more than likely had seen me at the grocery store That's what law enforcement's theory was. He saw you, he followed you unbeknownst to you, watched you walk into your apartment, and then he came into your bedroom. And it's, and I guess I have all these questions. He was never caught, by the way. It's a pretty crazy story. My mom came running out with her gun and everything. Like, it's just this whole thing. But it was terrifying. But I also wonder to this day, like, did he see me at the grocery store and it was a crime of opportunity? Like, I see her and I have an impulse and I'm going to do this. Mm-hmm. Or was it, had he been watching me for a while and then decided to, I don't know. Had he done this before? I suspect he had. Mm-hmm. Will he do this again? Probably. And that's what bothers me to this day, that he was never caught. It's like, gosh, how many, I got away with it with my life. Like, I'm still alive to this day and I'm very fortunate and I count my blessings. But did this happen again after that? And what was the outcome? Mm-hmm. It terrifies me to think about. But I just, I guess I can say that I can relate to having somebody in your personal space and not knowing it. And then looking back on it later as you're trying to process, like, oh my God, I didn't know I was being watched. I didn't, that's so creepy. And he was in my space. And what was he going to do? Because I caught him right as he was walking in and I startled him. So he thought he was going to sneak into my bedroom while I was still talking to my mom. Her window was open. There's all these details I'm leaving out. When I was talking to my mom, her window was open, but her blinds were closed. It was summertime. He was standing right outside of the window during that time. Oh. So he heard everything we said. He knew I wasn't in my bedroom. He took that opportunity, hopped over the little fence, went into my bedroom. I happened to walk in at the very second that he was walking in. He was caught off guard. He gave me some bullshit excuse like, I confronted him. I was like, what the fuck are you doing? I got really angry. Never thought I would react that way, but I was just angry. I felt invaded. And he's like, and he starts looking around my room and his wheels are spinning. He's like, I think my cat, oh, it's just my cat ran into your bedroom. I'm just looking for my cat. Obviously it was bullshit. Mm-hmm. But what was he going to do if I didn't walk in right at that moment? He was going to hide in the closet. Mm-hmm. He was going to hide under my bed. It was almost bedtime. It was probably 10 o'clock by this point. I don't know. It's the what ifs, you know, it could have gone very differently, but, I guess while I was watching this, it brought back little just thoughts of that event in my life. And I still don't have all the answers and that drives me crazy.
Mm-hmm. It was also, I don't discuss it at all on the show and I don't usually discuss it, but I was also the victim of stalking. And it went on for quite some time. It's long behind me and past me. I was very fortunate. I was proactive too, but it did take a while. I'd say the perpetrator was caught, was apprehended, was convicted and punished for stalking.
I'm so glad.
Yeah, so was I. And I was not the only person. There were multiple victims. But so I always feel grateful because there was some escalation, but not to this level. But when I see cases where stalking is not taken as seriously or it's diminished, you know, I just shake my head. Fortunately, in my case, I had a prosecutor and police who took it quite seriously. They believed he was quite threatening. And did a lot to apprehend him and make me part of the process and other victims. What do you want to happen and whatnot? So there are cases now that are taken a lot more seriously and stopped early on. So I didn't have the experience where I didn't know what, you know, what he would have done or what happened. I kind of had a feeling where it was going, but it was taken quite seriously, for which I'm grateful.
Sometimes the system does work.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you for sharing. And that is so refreshing to hear because we all hear about these true crime cases. And a lot of times law enforcement has been, you know, as of late, been put in the spotlight for not taking things seriously when it's very dangerous behavior. And just going back to what we said earlier, you know, these peeping Toms, which again, I wish it was called something different.
Right.
And these stalkers, these are huge red flags and indicators for very dangerous behavior to
very
come.
Dangerous precursors.
Very dangerous precursors. And it has to be taken seriously. And the whole peeping Tom thing, like, it's just, I keep racking my brain like, okay, what's the new name? But because it just sounds so light and fluffy, but it is not.
No.
Maybe so, creeper, thank you for sharing. Tom? Creeper Tom.
Say
creeping Tom. I don't know. Creeping Tom.
What'd you call it?
Like Creeping Tom. Maybe just not Tom. Just being creepy. I don't know. It's got to be a.
I know.
Got to be a better word. You're right. It really just minimizes it.
It does.
It does.
Yeah.
It does. Well, I like you. I really thought that this documentary was well done. I'm so glad that I got to know this case. It's so unfortunate that somebody's life was taken. And Carrie Farver, talking about her for a second, like we all said, she was, by all accounts, a loving and nurturing mother. She was a responsible human being in this world. She was a single mother doing it on her own. She was going places. And, you know, Liz, she just got in Liz's sights, unfortunately. And I do hope that at some point, I would imagine her family wants this, but I do hope that her remains are recovered at some point. I would think that might bring some level of peace, but there is no closure on something like this, I don't think.
I just want to say also that while cases like this are, they're very hard to look at, and you do wind up feeling such sympathy, and maybe you think, wow, this shouldn't be broadcast. This is a cautionary tale. There are so many dangers online and with dating and with catfishing, things that we didn't have our eyes open to about 15 years ago. But, you know, there are things, look, they're informational, they're educational too. And so people can take that for what it is. You can look at some of the red flags that, you know, maybe you wouldn't have seen and apply them in the real world, or just take note of these kinds of things. I think that they have some importance for awareness and making people really aware of what is really going on and how you cannot be sure.
Yeah. And Megan, I think your point applies to true crime more broadly. And, you know, I think the three of us understand the ethics of these stories, but yes, it's important that these stories are not just being told. They're not just entertainment. They're much more than that.
I agree with you, Holt, and I'm so glad you both brought that up. And when I listen or to true crime content, or I look into it, or I cover cases, I am not in it for the salacious details. In fact, a lot of times I will leave certain details out, in particular with children. But I absolutely can speak from my own personal experience. I have learned how to keep myself and my family safer by consuming true crime content. And I totally, there's a bigger conversation about, you know, ethics and true crime and should these stories be, you know, how should they be told? Should they be told? But I will say that it is a fact that I have learned how to keep myself safer. And I would imagine there are millions of other people who also have learned a thing or two about how to keep themselves safer, so not fall victim to crime.
Yep.
Yeah, I think so.
And as we often say too, you know, talking about these stories and the procedural parts of these stories and understanding what's going on from all sides, everyone who's listening to true crime is a potential juror. And I don't know about you, but if I found myself in a courtroom, I would want somebody on my jury who is a critical thinker, who was understanding the processes and the procedures. So we like to think of it like that as well.
I wholeheartedly agree with you. And I was the jury foreman on a first degree murder trial in 2017.
Wow. Yes.
And I also found myself going, oh my gosh, all of us here, like we're just lay people, right? Mm-hmm. But at the very least, you want somebody who's a good, to your point, Amy, a good critical thinker who can really, you know, think through this and process the evidence. And again, it's the weirdest thing because you see somebody on the witness stand and it's really, it's almost as simple as you just have to use your own instincts. Do I believe them or not? It sometimes is as simple as that. Like there would be eyewitnesses other witnesses on the stand. And I would go, yeah, this comes off as believable. And I would have reasons for it. Mm-hmm. But then there was one particular witness that I can remember that it was like, the circumstantial evidence in my mind was stacking up. Like, I just don't think I can put a lot of weight in what this person is saying for various reasons. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you bring up an interesting point, jurors. That's a whole nother conversation too, because
we'll have to do this again. There's so much to talk about.
There's so much there. Well, you know, I want to let the listeners know where they can find you ladies and your work. So why don't you kind of speak to that?
All right. Well, as you mentioned, Jamie, we are wherever you get your podcast, wherever you listen to Murderish, you can also find us, Women in Crime. We recently started doing YouTube, so you can also find us on YouTube, Instagram, Women in Crime Podcast is where you'll find us. Am I forgetting anywhere, Megan?
You know, Facebook.
I mean, we're not very tech savvy. So sometimes you see us on Facebook too.
We're trying though. We're definitely trying.
Are you guys Gen X? Are you Gen X or are you younger? You're probably younger than me.
No, I don't know what the generations are. What is Gen X? Like, what's the...
I think like if you consider yourself a 90s kid, like you kind of grew up in the 90s, you're probably Gen X.
Okay, yeah.
That's grew funny. Up I think in the I 80s thought, and I 90s. I think I thought I was younger, but nope, I'm Gen X.
Darn it. And I only bring that up because I'm with you. I only, you know, in the last year plus have been really active on social media because I have help. Yes. Otherwise, it's not what I want to do. I'm like, I have to learn how to do TikTok.
Yeah, sometimes I have to ask my 10-year-old questions, which is sad.
Yeah, so lucky that you have a 10-year-old to ask there. There you go. free labor, Amy.
Right? Yeah. I guess so.
Well, and, you know, as far I'm also on YouTube, everybody. So, yes. You can find, if you want to hear this episode in podcast form, you can just search Murderish. I'm in all podcast players. If you want to check me out on YouTube, I'm at Jamie on Air. That's J-A-M-I on Air. And I want to thank you all for being on the show. Oh, and don't forget to follow me on TikTok and Instagram. I'm very active there. I'm also at Jamie on Air on both of those platforms. And remember, cults are stupid. Ted Bundy's ugly. Scammers suck at life. And binging true crime documentaries is self-care. And don't let anybody tell you different. Ladies, thank you so much for being on the show. It was all my pleasure.
Thank you, Jamie. This was excellent.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. And we look forward to coming back on for another one.
I would love to have you on again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.